Good morning. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is Monday morning, April the 13th. Boy, time flies when you're having fun. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just note that you have some responses to a question from Representative Springer at your places on graduation rates, 4, 5, and 6-year graduation rates at the different universities. We'll be saving that under Thursday's hearing date, I believe. And then today you have a continuation of the public hearing on 5024. You'll be hearing about the statewide public services and capital construction, along with some closing remarks.
Mr. Cannon and Mr. Fox, we better open a public hearing on 5024.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Good morning. In the interest of time, I'm just going to turn it over to Brian to introduce the budget slide, and then we'll bring up the campus representatives to talk about the programs.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Brian Fox, Director of Public University Budget and Finance for the HEC. Today, we'll be sort of running over several topics, the first of which are the statewide public services housed at Oregon State University. The governor's recommended budget in the HEC recommends a CSL increase for the statewide public services, which include the extension service, the forest research lab, and the agricultural experiment station, all of which are housed at Oregon State University. The agricultural experiment station is the principal agricultural and related resource research agency of the state. They focus really on a large portion of our economic base and serve to generate innovations in agricultural, biological sciences, and the related sciences within Oregon. The Extension Service is the community-based educational outreach sector of Oregon. So it really extends from the classroom into the community, from the research into the community, driving forward and helping. I'm sure that there are folks here that have touched the Extension Services. And then lastly, the Forest Research Lab, which is Oregon's research agency directed at our timber resources. With that, I'm just going to turn it over quickly to three representatives from Oregon State: Dan Arp, the dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences; Thomas Maness, the dean of the College of Forestry; and Scott Reed, the vice provost and director of the Extension Services.
Gentlemen, come on up, or come on down.
Well, Senator, if we had all of our university pins, we could just change them out for each presenter.
That would work, or I could have worn my OSU tie today.
OSU day's tomorrow.
That's right.
Another chance.
Thank you for remembering that. Good morning.
Good morning.
Co-Chair Stump and Monroe, members of the committee, I'm Scott Reed, here today as director of the Oregon State University Extension Service, one of three distinctive statewide public services located at OSU. Together, we identify and create knowledge that benefits the economic prosperity, social capital, and natural systems of our state. Yeah, can you advance it? My bet is that you know many of our locations around Oregon, where you can find faculty and staff in every county, some at Learning and Discovery Forests, some at Agricultural Experiment Stations, and some at County Extension Offices. This distribution of our subject specialists to the places that are most needed allows for rapid response, highly applied, solution-based research. We say the state is our campus, and we mean it. Dan.
Good morning. My name is Dan Arp. I'm Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University and also serve in the role of Director of the Agricultural Experiment Station. As Scott mentioned, we work together. So the three agencies that you're hearing from this morning, the Ag Experiment Station, Forest Research Lab, and the Extension Service, work together to integrate and advance our programs. So the Forest Research Lab and Experiment Station are engaged in research. And in that research, we're discovering new knowledge. That new knowledge helps support applied research That applied research then through the Extension Service gets out to the end users. These are growers, these are foresters, these are communities who need this information. But as we're engaging with those communities, we're also learning from those communities about the issues that they face, the challenges that they have. And so that information comes back and informs decisions about what research we will actually do. So we work very closely together, even though we're here representing three separate budget lines. You've already seen this, but just to remind you, this is the base budget. This is from the governor's recommended budget and is also consistent with the language in the budget proposed by the joint co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee, and represents the budget lines for the three of us here who are speaking with you this morning.
Question.
Thought it might be help.
Madam Co-Chair.
I'm going to start with Mr. Siebert with this question. There was an article this morning about in the Oregonian about an audit being done at the Forestry Services, and maybe it doesn't fit here, but that how we really don't have enough funds in our Forestry Service. Does that fit here at all? Probably not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I'm not sure, but I will certainly talk to you after the meeting and we'll figure that
okay.
out.
Okay. Oh, I see. Well, Senator, Mr. Information Man down here.
Senator Roblin.
Two things. It depends on which part of the forestry. If it's the state forestry, it doesn't have as much. However, we did send a bill out of the Education Committee that had to do with an additional $16 million for some of these services, which would include some of that, which should be coming to this subcommittee, I would expect, because in talking to Oregon State and other groups, they had asked for this, but it was not included in a POP. So our committee had a hearing about it, talked about it, and we sent it this way because we do believe it's an important aspect of filling the need that exists beyond this. And I would hope we'll have a conversation about that in the future.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
So this budget, your presentation today but it deals with the governor's recommended budget. Is that correct?
No. Actually, we're just about to get to the additional $16 million request. So we wanted to start with a baseline, give you a sense of where the governor's recommended budget was, and then move on to what Senator Roblin has mentioned.
I'll be patient.
Okay. Just to give you a heads up, it's the next slide after this one. So
I won't step out then.
What we want to do with this slide is really just give you a sense of the trending, the funds over the past 15 years, so the historical trend here. And the blue line on top shows the funding as it goes up and down a bit. And this is the annual budget. So the slide before, of course, was biennial. This is then broken down into each year. And as we look at that, we see it bounces up and down a bit. But if you run a line through it, you see that there's been a slight increase. That amounts to about 0.5% increase per year over the last 15 years. If, however, you inflation adjust those, and we use the Portland Consumer Price Index to do that, you see that we've lost about 2.5% per year in terms of actual spending dollars, which amounts to about $682,000 per year. Just to put that into another context, that's about 5 positions then each year, faculty level professor positions that each year we're not able to fill because of this particular trending line. Next slide then gets us to the request then for the additional $16 million above and beyond the governor's recommended budget. This $16 million has been approved by our Board of Trustees, so they put that in their funding request. We forwarded that. And as Senator Roblin says, there's a bill that would support that $16 million increase. This increase addresses issues that the state has, so many of the areas that the state's trying to make progress in solving problems, we want to be a part of that, and that's what we would do with this additional $16 million increase. We have 5 areas that we've identified here. The first one is sustainable management of our working landscapes. That word working landscapes for us means everything from the oceans to the fields to the ranges to the forests, so all the different kinds of working landscapes that we have in Oregon. We also want to use those dollars to ensure water quality and quantity, that we have the right amounts of water for the needs that we have in the state, but also that it's of high quality. Also to help promote public health, food safety, and security. And we'll come through and embellish just a little on each of these. We would invest in technologies for business development and value-added manufacturing, and also help to educate the workforce of tomorrow. With that, I'll turn it over to Thomas.
Thank you, Dan.
Where are the big co-chairs on this request?
I've sent information to them. I haven't heard back directly yet. I think they are seriously looking at it, but I think it's going to be hard for them necessarily to find it. I just think it's really important.
You realize the process that the bill has to be sent to this subcommittee from Devlin and Buckley, and so be sure you're contacting them. Senator Roblin, as chair of the policy committee, is making that effort, but you need to as well. Okay, excuse me for interrupting you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs Comp and Monroe. My name is Thomas Manis, and I'm dean of the College of Forestry and director of the Forestry Research Laboratory. And I'm going to talk about a couple of the major challenges that we face and what the $16 million increase would, in particular, help us to conduct research. First of all, our rural landscapes across the state are working landscapes, and our research in the Agricultural Experiment Station and Forestry Research Lab is directly related to the sustainable management of these working landscapes. Many times we have species at risk that are causing significant conflict in the management of these lands. And while our funds have decreased over the last 15 years, the challenges, especially for rural landscapes, have increased. Two of those are, in particular, are sage grouse, which affects most of our working landscapes in eastern and central Oregon, and the marble murrelet, which is a major issue for coastal forests and coastal regions. We also have coho salmon and the spotted owl still as major challenges. We can really are engaged in conducting science in these areas, and science is desperately needed as we move forward and learn how to manage these conflicts. The second major area, I don't have to say too much about the importance of water with the situation that we're in and the announcement that was made in California to the south. Fresh water in our state generally originates on forested landscapes, and the quality of that water and the quantity of the water is directly impacted by the management of those landscapes. And water is absolutely essential to our agriculture industry. So these are areas that we perform a lot of research on to affect both quality and quantity of water. And we provide the science behind the land management practices
Senator
that we
Roblin.
Conduct.
I just want to make sure that people who aren't in the natural resource arena as much understand that when you talk about managing juniper, you are also managing water. The water table in eastern Oregon is at risk right now, and the juniper forests respirate so much water it's hard for the water to get down. So a lot of these things are interchangeable with regard to whether you're working on water or working on invasive species or working on the invasive species, all of those create the problem that rural Oregon is finding itself in right now.
And it's hard to think of these beautiful juniper trees as an invasive species, but they suck a lot of water up and make it difficult for the sage to grow and bloom, and that affects the sage grouse, so everything affects everything else.
Yeah. And thank you for that clarification, Senator Roblin. And the same is true in western Oregon and in California for our major forest species. In California, they're realizing that by thinning, they're increasing the water yield from forests. So it's the exact same principle. The water is either used and transpired in the forest or it's sent down the stream. And so forest management in the future is going to be directly tied to the not just the quality of water, but the quantity of water, and particularly the quantity of water in the low summer flows is really important that we manage the forest well to maximize that. I'll turn it back over to Dan.
And the theme of integration of these five areas will continue, but wanted to talk a little bit about promoting public health, food safety, and security. And I'll talk a little bit about food safety and security. Food security means adequate amounts of food, nutritious food that's available to people. And in the College of Ag Sciences and in these agencies we're talking about here, we integrate those across the three agencies. We work from soil to shelf. So we're looking at soil health. We're looking at new crop varieties. We look at then the safety of those foods as they move from farm gate to the shelf. So what do we do to take care to make sure that they're safe? That food safety can cover everything from high pressure sterilization techniques that are being perfected in the Department of Food Science and Technology to looking at E. coli counts on irrigation water in onion fields to make sure that those are below what they should be. Thank you. And with that, turn it over to Scott.
Thank you. Let me just add that beyond growing food and getting it to the shelf, food safety and security also is embedded in our College of Public Health and Human Sciences, where extension faculty focus on healthy behaviors that help people avoid costly health care through preventative health activities.
We also want to point out the importance of making investments in new technologies that help drive the economy. For example, in the agricultural realm, we're looking at technologies both pre-farm gate and post-farm gate. So an example, so helping farmers before the farm gate, before the commodities leave the farm, would be sensor technology that helps them understand how much water, how much irrigation water to use, but not just across an entire field, but within separate areas within that field. So be much more precise about the amount of water that's used. UAVs are another technology that we're helping to perfect in order to monitor fields and help make decisions about disease and water as well.
And a lot of our agricultural products are exported.
That's exactly right, Senator Moreau. So about 80% of the farm products are exported from the state and about 50% of those from the U.S. So a large amount of our ag products do leave the state and the country as well. That's correct.
Yeah, we always think of wheat, you know, and wheat is the number one, I think, agricultural product. But we also export a lot of lentils and soybeans and things of that nature. The problems at the Port of Portland are having a direct impact on some of those products.
That is correct, and especially wheat, because wheat is one of those where about 80% of that goes out the Port of Portland and to other countries. So that's a very good observation. With the products then, once they leave the farm gate, we're also trying to add value to those and help assist in those industries that add value. Excellent example of that's the fermentation industry, where you take milk, turn it into cheese, you take grapes, turn them into wine, and of course barley and hops and turn it into beer. And in each of those cases, you've added value by doing that, and we're there to help with those processes and to improve the efficiencies of those and to make new innovations in the value-added technologies. Thomas?
And I'll add to that just a little bit. You see in the slide there a picture of logs. Our forestry resource-dependent communities across the state really need help in terms of investment in those communities to add employment. And the task of the Forestry Research Laboratory is really to turn those logs into the highest value-added products that we can possibly make to increase the amount of employment, and particularly manufacturing employment in these communities. And to that end, we've started work on a new initiative partnered with the University of Oregon to turn those logs into tall buildings. And that's a subject that's been moving across the country now and becoming very much important, that we could export tall buildings to Asia and around the world. So this is an important area to create employment in rural communities across the state.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. A little bit of a rabbit trail here, Tom. So you're talking about making tall buildings, and then I heard you mention export. So where my question is headed is, will those be tall buildings in the states, in Oregon, And then how will the LEED certification factor into that? Because that is a struggle for wood.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. LEED certification is one type of building certification. There are other types of building certification, and there are new types being developed right now. As we move into the future, building certification is going to be more about energy use and climate use, and I believe you'll see that evolving. LEED certification right now recognizes only FSC certified wood, of which there's very little FSC certified wood in Oregon or in the Pacific Northwest or in the United States, for that matter. It's an international certification that you see more often in other places. But architects and engineers are absolutely dedicated to the ideal of building sustainable buildings, and that will be out of wood. And so they're driving the process to create a new type of certification system. And what we'll see happening in the United States, and I think in particular in the Pacific Northwest because of our proximity to the Pacific region, is a development of a building industry here. You know, where we'll be producing component materials for tall buildings. Here, we already have one tall building, 14-story building, announced for Gleason and 10th in Pearl District in Portland. We have another one announced in Minneapolis, another one announced in New York City. These are buildings that's going to change the way that we think about building in the future. And these buildings are built modular, so that all of the components are ready-made to be installed like an IKEA cabinet, if you want to think of it that way, in the factory, and the factories are located in rural communities. So we can see communities like Sweet Home transformed into a place where these buildings are built using materials that are produced in sawmills and plywood mills that are already located in these particular areas. That's going to be a real game changer as we move into the future and thinking about how buildings are built. And Oregon is positioned right now to be the center of this if we take advantage of it. We could also let somebody else develop that industry, and we could provide the logs to that other place, whether it's in Washington or Idaho or someplace else. But we have a real opportunity to do this. And your question is right on. The certification is a big part of that, and that's a big part of what we're working on. As you know, we already did a report on this for the governor's executive order, and it's something that we're taking quite seriously.
Follow up, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging my little rabbit trail here. So what are we talking time frame as far as rolling this out, where these rural communities would see the impact, feel the impact? And number two, I've been to a whole lot of mills, and they have, by necessity, scaled not their operation, but the size of logs that they manage down, because it's the only wood they can find. So do we have mills that are positioned to do this without a huge capital investment that has perhaps a significant risk involved, because LEED is still the driving certification and wood still pales in comparison based on LEED standards?
That's right. Well, the opportunity is right now. The very first cross-laminated timber manufacturer in the United States for structural CLT will be D.R. Johnson Lumber in Riddle, Oregon. So that's a rural community. That's an existing Oregon business. They have a sawmill on site, so they're using locally produced products, and that's something that we can really build on. And the first tall building that is built in the United States will likely be the building at Gleason and 10th. Well, that'll probably be the first one to happen. So that's what I mean by we're really positioned for this. And the partnership that we have with University of Oregon is absolutely unique in the country. There's nothing like that. So we're really well positioned. This can start happening now. We're trying to make connections for D.R. Johnson with architectural firms that would start the production of buildings here essentially now. And so we really need to get moving on this before other areas catch up with it. The LEED issue is I think it's an important one, but it has not been an issue for there are two producers of tall wood building components so far in North America. They're both in Canada, and neither one is producing FSC certified buildings at this point. So LEED is not effectively driving demand for this right now. We do need to take it seriously. We do need to have another type of certification system. And what I'm thinking, and maybe this is a dream, but what I'm thinking is that you've heard about the modern school of architecture. You've heard about Bauhaus School of Architecture. Well, I think we could talk about the Oregon School of Architecture as a new architecture that embodies sustainable materials and becomes popular around the Pacific Rim, which would be something quite incredible.
Thank you.
That's exciting. Senator Roblin.
And I've been fighting the LEED thing for a long time. There is one company in Canada that gets their wood certified. They do nothing different than the rest of them. It's just that they have a political long-time history of being. So we continue to have that conversation. The issue that we have is that we use clear-cutting, and they have this big deal about clear-cutting because of what's happened in Brazil. Correct. In our part of the world, it's the best way to harvest in a lot of cases, and the best way to maintain a good environment. Mother Nature does it here by forest fires. We'd rather do it by taking care of the forest the right way. But so I think there will be a conversation. The other thing I was going to say is that the other thing that Oregon State's done is come up with new adhesives, glue, that get the petroleum industry out of making fiberglass and other structural things. Based on some stuff that's been done at Oregon State and looking at the adhesive that mussels make to attach to rocks and looking at that genetically and making that kind of glue. And it's pretty amazing. And we can grow that here, too, because it comes from soybean flour and some other stuff. No odor. It's pretty amazing, actually. So.
And it also partners with agriculture because that glue for made from mussels goes way well with fish fries or made from potatoes. And
that's right. Are we still selling raw logs to Asia?
Yes. Actually, it's down a little bit right now, but the market for logs has increased over the last few years because the China market has picked up substantially. So we export about 2 billion board feet from the Pacific Northwest to Asia. If you think about the harvest in Oregon of being 4 billion board feet, that's a significant amount. And so the challenge for us is to create high-value products that can be locally produced to bring those logs back. You know, it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, you hate to see those logs going overseas and being processed over there, many times processed into something which is then sent back to us. But it's also a source of supply for a whole new industry that we have here, because that would be a major source of supply. So what's needed is to increase the value of the products that we produce here, which will change the economics and then make it more valuable to process those logs at home. The reason they're going offshore is because it's actually worth more to send them away than it is to process them here.
And your budget request for this additional $16 million, the portion that goes to forestry, will help continue this research? Is that the purpose?
Absolutely. That's a big part of our forestry research laboratory.
Okay. Senator Roblin.
Just to make it clear for people, we can only sell private logs overseas. You cannot sell state or federal logs overseas directly. We do process them. If you come to Coos Bay, we've got big stacks of logs again because they are producing a lot of jobs, and it's the private industry. So when you think about 4 billion total logs, 2 billion of it is coming from a very minor part of the property in our state that owned by private companies, which is significantly less than what's owned by the federal government. And that all those trees have to be used here locally. And we wish we could get the harvest up there as well. But when you hear the numbers, you realize how much, with so little land, our private industry has been able to do. In comparison to what we've been able to do with respect to our state and federal live forests. Couldn't go without saying that.
Madam Co-Chair.
It maybe is a simple question, but it's my understanding from this conversation, we're just talking about raw wood and not other products that are made from like wood chips with other products. I was at an architect's office and he was showing me they look like, all those things that the kids put underneath their beds in college, the cinder blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they have, it's a new type of a cinder block that they're using, some wood product, but again, that specialized glue and not using near as much concrete. Is that something you're involved in? Because I was like looking at it, and I think I even have a picture of one of them on my phone because I thought, wow, these are impressive at a much less cost.
Yes, thank you, Representative Comp. We're including all of these products, and this wood building initiative, cross-laminated timber is the structural part of it, and glue lam beams are that's the frame that holds the building up. But the building consumes wood products of many different types, and we have a very strong industry here that produces products like chipboard, which is made out of mm-hmm. exactly what you're talking about, which is generally using sawdust and particles like that. We also have a biomass industry here where we're producing electric power, and we produce almost all of the energy that's used in the manufacture of these products by the residuals. And we're inventing new products every day for this. Oriented strand board was originally designed as a structural product. It's made from flakes of wood that are broken. And now it's being used as an appearance product. It's finished, and you see it in some of these wood buildings. It's really quite beautiful. So what we're talking about is the full and complete range of products, all the way from chemicals like cellulosic ethanol is something that we're working on developing, and other types of chemicals, all the way to solid wood products like cross-laminated timber panels, which are 80 feet long, 10 feet wide, and a foot and a half thick.
It sounds like I need a tour again.
You got it.
Are you doing anything with industrial hemp?
Yes, this is an area that the Forestry Research Lab is working on right now, and I'm not as well versed in the types of products that they're producing, but this is a really growing industry because that's a very strong fiber.
It's a strong fiber, and it grows really fast. You can produce a lot more on an acre mm-hmm. in a lot shorter time. Trees take 60 years or more to grow, but you can have a hemp crop every year.
Just a question. So would you say that we probably need a new forestry research kind of building on the campus of Oregon State to include showcase for some of this?
I hadn't thought of that, but now that you mention it, I think it's a great idea. Yeah, that we are building a demonstration building for the home of the College of Forestry that Michael Green, Canadian architect Michael Green, is designing right now. But I think more importantly for our industry, we're building a research and support laboratory in our partnership with University of Oregon that will allow us to help businesses get started in this new industry for wood buildings. And that's something that we hope to get built very soon so we can start providing that support.
Okay, the fifth theme that we'll talk to you about today is one that integrates the discovery, learning, and engagement missions of the university. We believe that our unique installations statewide can provide more effective real-world learning opportunities for our students. A recent pilot that we've dubbed Open Campus has been working with our own 4-H Youth Development Program, the largest youth development program in Oregon, by the way, and community colleges to provide college and career pathways for kids, degree completion, and professional development for people who are place-bound and yet for whom some additional educational credentials can help. Your investment into the statewides are hard-working dollars. Looking only at the Extension Service faculty, each of our people supports about 70 trained volunteers. You know them as people like master gardeners, master woodland managers, master food preservers, master recyclers, master naturalists, and 4-H youth development adult leaders. This incredible leveraging allowed us to count about 2.1 million learners reached last year, about half of Oregon's total population. So, last slide.
And we wanted to finish by pointing out how the dollars that the state invests are leveraged by the statewides. So for a dollar that the state invests in the Ag Experiment Station, our scientists will go out and use those dollars to leverage an additional $2.5. Most of those additional dollars come from out of state, typically from the federal government, in grants and contracts. So each dollar gets another $2.5 put into the research that they're carrying out. But the real importance, of course, is the impact of the work that's done. So the impact of that work, basic studies show, has about a tenfold return on investment in the state. So a dollar invested by the state, by the time it rolls through the economy and has that value added, typically brings another $10 into the state's economy. If you include other states, the impact in other states, it's actually about a 20-to-1, according to various studies. And a simple example of that would be wheat, a new wheat variety that you invest state dollars into helping us develop a new wheat variety. That new wheat variety gets sold within the state. It helps increase yields. That increases the amount of wheat that then is sold to Asia. But it's not limited to Oregon. That wheat variety is also sold and is used in Washington and Idaho. So that's an example of how that economic leveraging can take place.
And I'll just quickly point out that in the case of the Forestry Research Laboratory, the statewide public service dollars are directly matched by harvest tax dollars that are from industry. And that's really a unique situation across the United States where industry taxes itself to help provide the science that's used for the Forest Protection Act that we have. And through that double matching, then those dollars are matched through grants and different types of contracts and so on, so that we provide a $6 in funding coming in for every $1 in the statewide public service, which is really incredible. So that concludes our testimony. We want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, all three of us, and we're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Senator Roblin.
And I just want to say, because yesterday we had groundbreaking at Newport for OMSI. So OMSI is building a new campus at Newport, and I see that as an extension of what they just mentioned. OMSI wouldn't be coming there if there weren't the other subsidiary things that are happening at Oregon State, also at Newport, mm-hmm. along with NOAA, along with the aquarium. It is getting that whole group of people that makes it possible for others to see the opportunity in these rural parts of the state. So we were excited about OMSI coming to Newport and look forward to the construction phase as well as the inviting guests to the coast and knowing that there will be other things for them to see there, provided by Oregon State University, provided by the federal government, and we'll look forward to it. So, thank you.
And Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One of the points that I want to make sure that we shine a spotlight on when we're talking about the statewides is the volunteer capacity. Mm-hmm. And I know that this slide touches on that a little bit, but the volunteer capacity that this builds is pretty incredible. I myself am a frustrated master gardener, and so that hasn't worked out too well for me recently. But I've been in the extension offices, and the volunteers that are in there doing a significant amount of this work, and those volunteers are also ambassadors to the program. Some of the extensions have been able to pass local operating levies. And I think that is in large part due to the volunteer capacity that is built. So I think I just want to make sure that we grab a hold of that piece. There are few areas, in my opinion, in government where we invest money and get such an exponential return on it as this. I mean, every dollar here brings lots more dollars, more than what your graphs are showing here, and I think it's about the best investment we have.
And this subcommittee for the last 8 years has looked very favorably upon funding your programs, and yeah. I'm sure we'll continue to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Ramey. Ben?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Again, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the HAC. You are attempting to cover several meaty topics today. The next section, and one of those meaty topics, is our request for capital investment by the state in the public universities. We have a few slides to run through to provide some background. I do want to note we brought this presentation to the Capital Construction Subcommittee a couple of Fridays ago, went through it in depth there. So we'll try to move very quickly in order to ensure that Mr. Ramey has an opportunity to help you understand the projects and the capital and the university's perspective on the requests that we're bringing forward. Just in a nutshell, these two lines are the budget request contained within the governor's recommended budget, and you see that compared with the 2013 LAB. Obviously, the first line here is a request for bonding capacity. It's not operating funds. It is that borrowing request. And the second line here is the obligatory debt service associated with prior projects that the state has approved. We'll move into just a few sort of slides for background.
Yeah, so these slides there in the next several represent sort of a little bit of a story of what the university capital portfolio represents compared to the state's overall portfolio. In the universities represent 51% of the state's capital. So that sort of brings to bear why it is that the universities come forward with significant capital requests. As the state in times has backed out in operating requests, has really stepped up in capital to allow the institutions to extend their capacity. Embedded within the university is really two sets of assets. One's E&G, education in general. This is core classroom research space. And then auxiliary and other, this has to do with housing, dining, athletic operations, et cetera. And so the focus for state resources tends to be, or generally is, education in general. This slide walks through some of the deferred maintenance, really the backlog of facility overhaul that's required at the institutions. This data comes from 2012 for most of it, and then the seismic backlog on the far right is actually from 2007, so it's a little bit dated. But what you'll notice is that there's a significant, in the third column over, that a significant amount of the space at the universities is well over 30 years old. There was a building boom in the 60s and 70s, which built out the institutions in response to growing cohorts of students. Those buildings are really coming due. At this point, many of them have lived their useful lives. The mechanical systems embedded within them have lived or outlived or barely live throughout their useful lives, and that sort of creates this deferred maintenance backlog. As the institutions have run with scarcer and scarcer dollars, they've prioritized core operations, which oftentimes has pushed off some of these maintenance requests. And so what we have done in our capital request, you'll see, is many of the buildings are really complete overhauls. It's taking the shell of a building that's there, gutting much of it, remodeling, adding in new mechanical systems.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back one slide, please? I just wondered if you have a comparable, it's helpful to look at the deferred maintenance backlog as a per GSF, as per square foot. Do you have any similar numbers for the seismic backlog?
So we could compute given the information that's here, so I can run those ratios. I will warn that the seismic backlog is from 2007, and so the total space at the institutions has changed significantly. Okay. That information is dated. And many projects have come forward that are dedicated to seismic retrofits.
Okay. One short follow-up. And also, can you give me a sense of how, is there overlap between those two categories, between the deferred maintenance backlog and the seismic backlog?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, so I would anticipate yes, but I'd like to sort of follow up with you on that.
Thank you.
And this next slide just provides a sense of where that deferred maintenance is, right, in mechanical systems, electrical, et cetera. It's really spread all over. Here you'll see the historic investment in dark gray or black is really the state's investment in general funded obligation bonds or in lottery bonds supporting capital construction. And you see some really significant growth, or you'll see some very significant years or very significant biennia. The green is campus or non-state funded. So the institutions have brought to bear a significant amount of private resources or their own resources to build and extend their capacity. And this slide represents the debt service. And I know that we've seen this before when we were discussing operating, that as the state has invested more and more over the last decade in capital budgets for the universities, those bills are coming due in the form of debt service payments. We anticipate that that will grow once again next year if the capital request is granted. On this slide, there are several reauthorization projects, two of which have already been sort of dealt with through the reauthorization bill, and so I won't spend much time here as these were approved in prior sessions. The two that are left are both funded by institutions.
The remaining few slides in our presentation walk through the process that our commission used to develop the recommendations that you'll see in the final slide, the list of projects. And I think the primary thing to note is that we adopted a set of principles. They are principles that we believe reflect the state's primary interest and institutional interests in extending the capacity of buildings, maximizing their usefulness, meeting the state's educational and institutional's educational objectives, generating operational cost savings in some cases, leveraging non-state resources. And we took those principles, we turned them into a rubric with opportunities for campuses to sort of get points for projects based on our staff analysis of the extent to which they met these priorities. And then we came up with a ranking that reflected the scoring against those against the rubric, and it this ordered list. I'll just note, since we'll go through the projects very briefly here in a moment, but just note that the first line here really reflects the commission's emphasis on capital repair and renewal. This is not a building project. This is a lot of projects designed to extend the life of buildings, to catch up with some of that deferred maintenance. And the commission actually granted more or recommends more in that funding than the campuses initially requested, and we think that's an appropriate move for the state at this point, at this moment in history, to really emphasize the maintenance of our the facilities that we have.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ben, I don't keep up on my economic status in the nation and the world as much as I should, but could you talk a little bit about the current bond rating and what the bond ratings have been through the last couple of cycles? When you say this is a time for a good investment, I'm putting those pieces together saying, oh, must be still an appropriate time to invest at low rates.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, the state of Oregon, so many of the general funded bonds are will carry the bond rating of the state of Oregon, which is very high. It continues to be high.
Excuse me, what's high?
What
is the definition of high?
So I can look up the state's bond rating and return it to you. I believe it's a double A.
Okay. I'm thinking of a different rating.
What's another piece that's important to note is that interest rates continue to be very, very low. It is likely.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, and that's the piece where right now while interest rates are low, it's advantageous for us to extend out. And the universities over the past several years have extended the maturity of most, if not all, of the bonds in which they can to capture low interest rates, reduce debt service costs over the life of those bonds. And they continue to do that, and the treasurer continues to do that.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to quickly walk through each of the projects. If folks have questions,
I'll let him walk. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm anxious to hear, since you are going to walk through the list, I'm anxious to hear I have to admit, I looked at this list last week sometime and was going through it. Certainly, the three big universities are at the top of the list, and the four regionals are at the bottom of the list. So I'm anxious to hear, and I realize this, there is a letter signed by all the presidents. So I'd like to hear some of that in your explanation as you talk about these investments.
Absolutely. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Springer, you know, as we went through the scoring rubric, the leveraging funds that the large institutions are able to bring to bear oftentimes differentiated the projects where they would score otherwise for par, right? That leveraging funds that the large institutions were able to bring to bear pushed those projects largely up. I think that as we move forward as a commission, we're going to have to focus on how we on ensuring that the regional institutions have access to state capital, and that we and that as they're able to bring those, probably not as much, but some of their own or private resources to bear, that be rewarded in somehow or another commensurate with their means. I mean, you have to recognize that the regional institutions in Portland State, to some degree, will not have the capacity to do 50% matches for large campus buildings in the way that some of the other institutions can.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a brief follow-up on that. And there's a huge difference, and we're not going to change that. And do we want to change that? I don't think it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. The difference isn't a bad thing. But we are talking about universities that have great athletic capacity and bring in dollars that way. We're talking about research universities, and those are great things. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of those things in our state. But just because we have four regionals that struggle to do those things, we do need to find a way to bring them up to a level where they can work in a rubric that is maybe designed for larger universities, quite frankly.
So I'm going to sort of quickly walk through these projects. If there are questions, holler. I'm going to sort of put my head down and read some notes. The first priority for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and the first recommended our budget is $71.9 million in Article 11 Q bonds for deferred maintenance, capital repair, and renewal. These are focused on maintaining the assets that are currently exist at all institutions. This is an omnibus package that will be sort of split up according to the gross square feet of each of the institutions so that all institutions have access to these dollars. Our second priority and our first sort of major capital asset is Neuberger Hall at Portland State University. This is a deferred maintenance and renovation project totaling $70 million, including $10 million in private match, and is one of the most important and heavily used buildings on PSU's campus. It upgrades and replaces major systems to remain safe and operational, and failure to fund this renovation project could result in closure of a building that is really on the edge. It includes 37 classrooms and 18 laboratories, and again, is a key asset of Portland State University. Our third project is Oregon State University's Forest Science Complex, of which there was some discussion earlier. It's a $60 million project, including $30 million in private matching funds. It would construct an advanced wood products laboratory, develop new testing for commercial projects, really extend a competitive advantage or a possible competitive advantage of the state in advanced wood products. It would also renovate and expand the current research and classroom facilities in PV Hall. Our fourth is Klamath Hall renovation at the University of Oregon. This is an $18.5 million project, including $6.25 million in private matching funds. It's the home of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry, one of the most productive departments at the University of Oregon, and it would provide lab and learning space, better equip students, and really extend the research capacity of the University of Oregon. Fifth on the list is Oregon State University's Marine Studies Campus, Phase 1, a $50 million project, including $25 million in private matching funds. This extends the capacity of Oregon State University as a leader in marine studies, creates a new pathway for transdisciplinary ocean research and education, extends marine studies education outreach and research along the entirety of the Oregon coast, and foster significant economic development along the coast, really leveraging the location of the NOAA fleet, other University of Oregon assets, kind of building a cluster on particularly in Newport, but along the Oregon coast. Six of the University of Oregon's College and Careers Building, a $34 million project, including $17 million in private matching funds. It's a 50,000 square foot renovation, including the addition of 450 classroom seats. Is home to the College of Arts and Sciences and the home for the Future Career Center at the University of Oregon. Number seven on the list, it's worth noting on the list that's up there, seven and eight are two projects. Those have been combined through a technical adjustment in the governor's recommended budget into one, the phase one of the Center for Engineering Technology at Oregon Tech in Klamath Falls. This is a 40,000 square foot additional new space, includes $1.7 million of campus match. This is one of those times where the regional institution is able to recognize this is a core need for the institution. They're willing to bring some of their own funds to bear, and that really brought it up the list. This space includes special purpose engineering spaces that you won't find at many other institutions. They include a wind tunnel, tensile strength testing, welding labs, et cetera, and this really serves as a first phase for redoing all of Cornett Hall, which is core engineering space in Klamath Falls. Number eight at the University of Oregon, the Chapman Hall renovation, a $10.5 million project, including $2.5 million in private matching funds. This is a deferred maintenance project. It will completely revamp Chapman Hall, which is the home to the Robert D. Clark Honors College. It creates a much more functioning learning environment. If folks have ever toured that building, they'll understand why it needs a revamp. Number nine, Western Oregon University's Natural Science Building, is a $6 million project. This is the top deferred maintenance and renovation priority of Western Oregon. This is really about revamping an entire building instead of requiring sort of an omnibus package to do one-off projects. This is revamping an entire building from top to bottom. This is the repurposing, or included in that is repurposing much of the space after the addition of a new science building at Western Oregon. Number 10 at Southern Oregon University, the Britt Hall renovation is a $4.8 million project. This remodels 67,000 square foot, includes a seismic retrofit and mechanical upgrades. This building includes a key large multipurpose and classroom space, one of the few large classroom spaces at Southern Oregon. It is the home of their Enrollment Services Center and often sort of the first view that students have of Southern's campus. At Eastern Oregon, this includes almost $3 million in Article 11 Q bonds for the demolition and site restoration of Hunt Hall, which is truly an eyesore on their campus and presents significant safety concerns and very expensive operation. And last on the list of the University of Oregon is the Learning and Innovation Hub and the home of the School of Architecture and Allied Arts, a $53.25 million project, including a 50% match. This would create cutting-edge facilities and multipurpose teaching possibilities, increase access, add more than 50% to the university's needed classroom space, serve as a core facility for the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network, or RAIN. This is a very large project, would include studio lab fabrication space for digital arts, metal smithing, sculpture, ceramics, and eliminate the need for much lease space off campus for the U of O. And with that, I'll turn it over to Chris Ramey, the university architect from the University of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, before we start.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. And maybe this will be part of Chris's presentation, but we have a very comprehensive list of projects here. What would be the approximate timeline if they're funded to beginning to end?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, bonds are, once authorized, aren't sold until the sort of the end of the biennium, so the debt service wouldn't start until the subsequent biennium. So some projects, ones that are funded with campus funds, could start sooner and then sort of run through the campus funds and then move on to the state-backed funds. But typically, we wouldn't see projects coming to completion until 2017, 18, and possibly even 19, depending on construction schedules.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Monroe and Comp, members of the committee, my name is Chris Ramey. I'm the university's architect and the associate vice president for campus planning.
Leaving you alone.
Design and construction, apparently on my own. Thank you very much. I hope I don't hear a door slam behind me. I want to emphasize what's already been mentioned is, and this is in your packet today as well, that all seven universities have come together on this request and collaborated. And I think that's unusual. I've been on campus for 25 years, so this is the first time we've done something like this that I'm aware of, and it's really remarkable. And a great tribute to the leadership of the HEC and the presidents themselves.
Makes our job a lot easier.
Well, good. That's all good then. So Brian and Ben have walked through the capital projects and, in fact, have stolen a lot of what I was going to say to you. So it's really my job just to bring a highlight to some of those things and put a face to some of the projects if I can. Overall, our projects fall roughly into two main categories, those that meet learning needs and those that address safety issues. And all the projects address these issues in some way or another. One of the first things I want to talk about is the fact that the public universities in the state have actually grown tremendously over the last 10 years, added 20,000 students, which is the equivalent of a large campus all on its own. And that kind of growth really demands a sort of concurrent growth in facilities. So that's a lot of what we're trying to do. At the university, for example, we estimate that we need about 1,300 more classrooms to actually get us back to a ratio of students to classroom seats. I should have said classroom seats, not classrooms. And the ratio to students to classroom seats is a metric that we use over time. And if we have 1,300 more, we can get back to a metric that was in place about 10 years ago. So we're really struggling with this enrollment, and these projects really help us get there. In fact, the projects in this request get the university about 80% of that 1,300 classroom seats that we need. And again, I know that's the same on other campuses.
Tim Smith Warner has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if I missed this for a moment early. So we've added 20,000 students in what timeline?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and Representative Smith Warner, I believe that is over 10 years.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to mention that, and I started to mention that these classroom seat needs are being accommodated in other projects as well, not obviously in the university, but in all the other requests as well. And then most importantly, a lot of these renovations will modernize learning spaces. So a lot of the spaces that were built in the 20s and 30s and 50s and 60s don't really have this kind of technology in them. Forget about trying to get Wi-Fi or even plug in your laptop to charge it up during a class. And so these are the kinds of things that modernization and new classrooms allow us to do. I was actually quite surprised to learn that the capital resource at the state of Oregon was 50% in public universities, and I guess I should know better, having worked in that field for 25 years. But that is a staggering number, and I think at its core really demonstrates the size of the need that's in front of us. And when one considers the age of those buildings, and we have buildings on our campus that are 125 years old, but the great majority of them were built in the 50s and 60s, and all of those systems are failing, and that's all coming due to us now. So again, the staggering need really reflects that size of that capital, and we want to renew those spaces. We want to protect them. We're going to deal with safety issues, seismic upgrades, accessibility issues, and then what's not on this slide, we're also dealing with energy issues, how to make the buildings more energy efficient so that as we go forward, we can reduce that energy need for our campuses as well. So I know that Ben and Brian both talked about this 71.9 omnibus number. It's number one for a reason. It is super important to us. I know on our campus, it's about a $4 million annual current from the last cycle. It's about $4 million. This will move it to $6 million and change. That doesn't seem like a lot on an annual basis, but it makes a huge difference to us. And just a couple of examples, and we're trying to keep the roofs up to date on the buildings, for example. We're trying to keep the windows so they operate and so they're weatherproofed. Elevators. If you have 200 buildings on campus and you think about an elevator has a 20-year cycle, you can do the math about how many. That's like two or three a year, and you're still not keeping up, and each of those is a several $100,000 cost to upgrade and renovate an elevator. So these kinds of numbers really, really chase us every day, and every day we worry about how we're going to handle this. At the bottom there, I want to talk a little bit about the access to the buildings. The ADA is at least a 30-year-old initiative from the federal government and trickling on down to us. When I was a young architect, we began thinking about these issues of how do we make every space accessible to every person, every member of our society. And as time has come, we've found how to do that more and more. And these dollars are really about bringing that sort of three categories. An absolute need where we've leased a building off campus, or we've purchased a building that has to be brought to our standards, or we simply not have the resources to deal with an issue right away. That's the first thing we need to do. Secondly, we're catching up on the regulations that they change over 30 years. So while we're technically meeting the requirements of them, we're not actually meeting the requirements of them now, so they work sort of for everybody. And then finally, this idea of universal access, where it's not okay for two different people who come to a building able different ways to enter two different doors. We want to be able to make everybody come through the same door. With our historic buildings, that's very difficult to do, and I think these dollars really help us to begin to address those issues, making access for all citizens, everybody that comes to the campus.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Could you give us a couple of, or just even one or two examples of what kind of accommodations are there for blind, deaf, somebody that is paralyzed? Our veterans returning back from war have multiple disabilities, physical disabilities. Mm-hmm. How is that impacting your planning?
Again, co-chairs Monroe and comp members of the committee, we have brought this in the concept of universal design. We have brought this to the forefront of our thinking about buildings so that we begin thinking about them again, as I said, about these two different individuals who come to the building could be very differently abled. And in particular, things that you wouldn't think about, like the lighting in this room, mm-hmm. there's certain wavelengths to the lighting that will set off people who have certain kinds of autism or other sort of visual, it could be partially blind, that difference in brightness in the window in your face makes it really hard for me to see you if I have a vision issue. Delivering things like websites and technology in alternative modes so that a blind person can get it hearing if they can't see it on the board. So all of these things come into play in what we call universal design. And we really grasp them, and we make them a part of the design from the start. But what it means is now that we're aware of these things, we need to go back and do all those buildings that we built in the last 125 years and make sure all of them can come up to that standard as well.
Thank you.
I hope that answers your question.
Yes, very well. Thank you.
Stating the obvious, capital construction is economic development. This is a graphic from the U of O's economic impact statement this year, and I don't have the exact numbers, and I'm sorry I forgot to ask, but I think it's somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 jobs that are created with these projects that are before you today. And these, of course, are construction jobs, but they're generally high-paying jobs. They're prevailing wage jobs. All of our projects are prevailing wage. And that is a direct impact on the economy, and something that really shouldn't be ignored. Spinning off of that, then, is and we've heard about this with the Forest Science Complex, and I'm, as an architect, really delighted to hear that stuff. That's really great. We're building a building on campus right now that is heavy timber. Our student union is a heavy timber building with a steel moment frame, which is probably more details than you want. But it's a first of a kind, again, three stories of wood timber. You wouldn't, even 2 years ago, you wouldn't have thought of that. So the industry is really, really rapidly progressing. And so these projects add to the campus's ability to spin off this kind of technology. And in the case of Klamath Hall, a lot of that basic research that happens in chemistry turns into spin-off companies. And that, again, many of those stay in the state and create jobs as we go ahead. And at the end of the day, I know that we tend to come in here with our hands out and say, could we please have some more money to do some more projects? And you must be exhausted listening to that all day long. And I think I kind of wish we would have started with this, because we need to go back and say, hey, wait a minute. You did this for us, and we created these awesome projects, and they're having these hugely positive effects on our students and our researchers and the public. And here's just three examples that were easy to grab. One from our campus, which was a deferred maintenance project from 2 years ago. It was a building built as a men's dormitory, then sort of badly converted in the 70s, a psychology department. And it's from the 1920s, so by the time we got in there, the pipes, a lot of the steam pipes had completely closed in their corrosion, mm-hmm. so the steam was actually not getting through the pipes to the radiators. And it's sort of that sort of level of system failure. At the same time, we saw an opportunity to add 1,000 new classroom seats. Mm-hmm. So we did this combination project of deferred maintenance and classroom seat addition. It's a fabulous project. It's just opened a few days ago for the part of for this term, the classroom part opened. Then I'm less familiar with these two projects, but the Oregon Tech project in Wilsonville, and then the Collaborative Life Sciences building. Vim's here, isn't he? Well, I hope I don't step on it here, but I heard this described as a, and I can never forget it now that I've seen it, a book on its edge, and then a stapler next to it. That building, and I actually saw a presentation where one of the architects described it that way. I said, "Well, how did that come about?" So, once that image got with them, it certainly stayed with me. So, finally, probably using up a little bit more of my time than I should have, just to sum it up, really, the need is enormous, and it's a great opportunity for us to meet that need in ways that expand our capacity for Oregon students and the rest of users of our facilities. We can through capital renewal, we can protect that asset, and we can improve it through those capital renewals projects. We've talked a lot about the private money that's in this, the $120 million that's leveraged by these, and I think that's no small feat. The other thing is that those donors become more connected with the institutions. Once they're connected with the building, then there's other ways for them to be connected as well, so it has sort of a spin-off effect. And then, as I mentioned, it really does create jobs. It's a wonderful program that creates jobs in all the campuses across the state. So with that, I'm not sure who I'm handing it off to at this point, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy.
The Sports Action Lottery people are up next. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it. Yeah, we are running short on time, so we'd ask the Sports Action people to keep their comments brief so that we leave time for President Wiebel. Okay, who's going to kick it off?
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, and members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. For the record, my name is Barbara Deering, and I'm the Executive Director of Intercollegiate Athletics at Western Oregon University. In a few minutes, very few now, I, as well as my colleagues from the other public universities in Oregon, would like to share some information on the positive effects of the sports lottery funding. Regardless of participation in NCAA Division I, II, or the NAIA, the common denominator in Oregon is this: sports lottery funding directly and uniquely impacts Oregon's seven universities and funds scholarships for student athletes and graduate students. It is a significant and necessary component of our successful athletic and graduate education programs, creating opportunity where opportunity might not otherwise exist. Some brief history on the sports lottery funding, which you'll be able to see here from the slide. The program started in 1989 when the legislature created the Sports Action Lottery Program as a way to raise funds for the intercollegiate athletic programs at Oregon's public universities. In 2005, the legislature ended the Sports Action Lottery Program and replaced it with a guaranteed 1% of lottery funds. The guarantee only lasted one biennium, and the allocation has fluctuated and reduced in subsequent years. The 2015-17 governor's recommended budget zeroed out this program, although the co-chair's budget framework restored the sports lottery funding to $8 million. The sports lottery is divided into 88% of the funding for intercollegiate athletics and 12% for graduate student academic scholarships. The 12% dedicated portion of the sports lottery proceeds has been invested in graduate scholarship support for students and programs across all institutions and programs, annually providing approximately $500,000. As you can see, you know, again, here's the historical funding. The $8 million provides approximately $1 million for the University of Oregon and Oregon State University, and nearly $1 million for Eastern Oregon University, Southern Oregon University, Oregon Institute of Technology, approximately $1.1 million for Western Oregon University, and $2.2 million for Portland State University. Elimination of this crucial funding for universities, as proposed in the governor's recommended budget, would be devastating, and particularly so to those universities with little to no access to media revenue. This funding allows Oregon's public universities to sustain two unique populations, student-athletes and graduate students, with avenues of financial aid that make a college education possible. In addition to bolstering the dream of a college education for student-athletes and graduate students, the sports lottery program assists the public universities in making significant strides to provide female student-athletes equal access and opportunity to the field of intercollegiate athletics required by Title IX of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Particularly at the true institutions, sports lottery funding is a primary way that campuses are able to meet these Title IX requirements to equitably fund women's athletic programs. Institutions are constantly monitoring parity in scholarships, facilities, and opportunities, and a swift loss of funding would imperil these opportunities and compliance efforts. Not only would the individual dreams of student-athletes and graduate students be jeopardized if the Sports Action Program were zeroed funded, but also would pose a significant legal and compliance risk for our universities as we try to backfill Title IX efforts to ensure they move forward. The impact of sports lottery is widespread. In 2013-14 academic year, for example, the sports lottery funding benefited over 25 student-athletes. You can see from the graphic that these student-athletes are distributed across the state and across Oregon's public universities. They come from counties and communities throughout Oregon to study, compete, graduate, and succeed. College is now possible for nearly 300 student-athletes at Eastern Oregon University with scholarships that the sports lottery funds. For the larger campuses, the reach is nearly 1,300 student-athletes. Imagine the impact of these 2,500 students if sports lottery was zero funded. What would our universities do to bridge the gap for these students? How many would have to leave our public universities? For some students, intercollegiate athletics offers a doorway to a college education, and the sports lottery scholarship makes this possible. University of Oregon women's basketball coach Kelly Graves will spend more time on the positive impact of intercollegiate athletics on our students. But I leave you with this request, and it's very simple. Keep and sustain the sports lottery funding in the co-chair's 15-17 budget framework to benefit our students and to benefit our state.
Thank you, Barb. Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee, it's an honor and privilege to be here today. For the record, my name is Kelly Graves. I'm the head women's basketball coach at the University of Oregon, and I'm going to cut my remarks very short because I know you want to hear the student athletes. I just want to say that as a coach, I am basically the person to just share in the successes and the joys of my student athletes, to share their journey with them, to help them create and achieve their dreams. I always say it's not coaching is a calling. It's not necessarily a profession, and I certainly love what I do. I've had a chance that you get to know these young ladies right from the beginning, in high school, and you nurture that relationship all the way through really the rest of their lives. I mean, I share in their successes after college. I meet their families. I go to their weddings. I've laid several to rest, and you become part of their lives. And so I see the impact every day in how athletics, helps these young people. I Listen, I have a chance every single day to go to work and work with the best and brightest that this young generation has to offer, and that's something very powerful. So I'm not going to go through a laundry list of all the great things that we know athletics teach us, all those values from hard work to overcoming adversity to teamwork, you know, all those things we've heard a million times. To me, what is very special and the most special about athletics is just the sense of belonging, being part of something that's bigger than you. Because when you're part of a team, it, I think, is the most powerful bond that you can have outside of family. And so because of that bond, I think people grow even, you know, greater and become even better people, really grow into the people this world needs most right now. So, you know, with that being said, I we've heard that student athletes graduate at a higher rate than the regular student population. The retention is greater. I know at the University of Oregon, over the last 5 years, student athletes have graduated at a percent of 80%, so considerably higher than the regular student population. On top of that, just the everything that comes along with being part of athletics, the camaraderie, the team spirit, the school spirit, everything is on display. For 28 years, I coached for the Jesuits, never had football. So for this last year, when I got to the University of Oregon, I see the power that football, you know, has in bringing a community together, a state together. And to me, it's just a thrill. So I would hope that this the sports action funding, you know, it's not nullified. You know, I hope we continue because, like I said, I see the benefits of it every single day. Thank you very much. And I'm going to turn it over to the real stars of the show here. So thank you very much, Chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Kelsey Scher, and I am a junior at Oregon State on the women's cross country and track and field team. And I would like to tell you how my athletic scholarship has fulfilled a dream and secured my future. I'm a born and raised Oregonian. I grew up in Tigard, and I was passionate about sports since I was really young. My parents told me that as long as I kept my grades up, I could participate in any sport that I could fit into my schedule. And so when I entered high school, I began to realize that I had a passion for running and was talented enough to compete with some of the top tier athletes in the Northwest. This passion and talent inspired my dreams about earning a scholarship to run in college. I'm here today because my previous dreams are my present reality. Because of this scholarship, I have fulfilled a dream to run. Because of this scholarship, I am able to commit myself wholeheartedly to my academics and my athletics without worrying about how much debt I will have after college. Because of this scholarship, I have been able to relieve any stress my parents may have had about being able to fund my education. And lastly, because of this scholarship, I have secured a future for myself. During my time as a student athlete at Oregon State, I've been blessed to gain personal and professional growth. The support within Oregon State's athletic department has provided opportunities for me to learn how to apply the skills I've gained in school and in sport to become a contributing member of the workforce when I graduate. In June 2016, I will graduate with degrees in marketing and finance, internships on my resume, and a large network of individuals whom I could call upon with just about any request. And when I look back at these accomplishments, I see a driving force behind them all, an athletic scholarship, an opportunity that allowed me to pursue my education in a major that I was passionate about, an opportunity that introduced me to individuals for whom I would be honored to someday work for, and lastly, an opportunity that has given me a strong support system to help me face whatever hurdles life will present. Ultimately, I wouldn't be here today unless it was for that scholarship. And I'm thankful for the opportunity to speak to you all and tell you how this funding has afforded me more than I could have ever imagined. Please fully fund the Sports Action Lottery at the 1% level so others will be able to thrive the way that I have.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp and members of the committee, my name is Nakia Evans, and I am a local Oregonian. I graduated from South Salem High School. And I'm currently on both athletic and academic financial aid at Portland State. I graduated high school as valedictorian and was recruited to play soccer for Portland State. And although maintaining my 3.98 GPA, I lost a large portion of my renewable academic aid after the first year due to the budget fluctuations. I'm currently in my second year, but thankfully athletics stepped up and has continued their financial support of my higher education. And it's due to this support that I'm able to attend college and pursue my dreams of one day being a doctor. Right now I'm majoring in biology, minoring in chemistry, and by the end of next fall, I will have completed all of my pre-med requirements. Not only does college athletics provide student athletes with many of the life skills employers covet, including leadership, discipline, teamwork, and integrity, it also fosters an environment where we are also taught the importance of giving back. PSU athletes alone, we work with Friends of the Children in READ Across America, the Student Athletics Advisory Committee. We have raise toiletries for local shelters as we travel, and we attend public lectures and GPS events. We're also ambassadors for Oregon schools in general out of state, and we're a 24/7 marketing system in state. We show a lot of people who, oh, we show a different subset of the population that might not otherwise look at college as an option, as a way to go to college and further their education. I have quite a few friends in high school who would not be going to college if it wasn't for the carrot of an athletic scholarship. As student athletes, we largely don't have the time to work. And so that's one reason why the scholarship is so important to us. In preseason, we do 40-hour weeks with training and meetings and lifting. And right now, for soccer, we're in spring season, so we're 20-hour weeks. But that, in addition to all our academics, leaves just about enough time to study. I'm still having to borrow some money for school and education, and so that will impact me paying for medical school later on. But this money is so important for this special subset of the population that may not otherwise attend college. But I'll turn it over to our President Wim Wiebel.
President Wiebel, yes, to bring us home.
Thank you very much, co-chairs and students and everybody else. I have, what, minus 2 minutes?
Yeah, something.
Yes.
I'll try to be very succinct.
You're in overtime.
You're in overtime. Right.
I'll try to score that winning goal. How's that? You've heard a lot of testimony over the last X many days, and there's really nothing new I can add, but maybe pull some things together. What you're talking about very much here is about investing in the future, right? It's not about solving today's crisis. It's about preventing those same crises from recurring and recurring and recurring. It's about investing so we don't have problems next year and next decade. We've been talking about $755 million, and we've said that would match what we had in the 07-09 biennium. In a way, we've been lying to you, because it really doesn't match that, because we now have about 20 or 25% more students, and there's been about 15 or 20% inflation since then. To really match what we had then, we'd have to ask for $1 billion, but we just thought that would freak you out, so we didn't. If you really want to get the people who haven't been traditionally going to college, the underrepresented minorities, veterans, and others, those who haven't gone to college, if you want them to go, you need to make this investment. If you want to educate Oregonians rather than just import skilled labor, you have to make this investment. If you really want students to have the time to study rather than to work and have those jobs and incur those debts, you have to invest. And if you really want us to have the advisors, the financial aid and financial aid counselors, and the faculty so students will actually get through in a reasonable time, you have to make this investment. We know, and you know, that we can't raise tuition much more than we already have. During the recession, the state and us have balanced our budgets on the students' backs. Our students already are working a lot. 44% of our incoming freshmen work more than 20 hours a week. They can't work anymore. 40% of our freshmen are underrepresented minorities, and 35% come from homes where a language other than English is spoken. Wow. To get to them, to get them to come to the university, to give them the support, takes time and money. We can only offer one advisor for every 600 students, while the national standard is one advisor for every 300 students. And again, the story is similar at our sister institutions. And finally, could we ever be more efficient? As all large institutions, we always have to work diligently to make sure that we wring out any kind of waste, any kind of inefficiency. We continue to use technology to become more efficient and effective. But as you well know, Oregon already is 46th or 47th in the nation in its investment in higher education. And what we spend per student when you add up tuition and state aid, we're about 49th in the nation. So nobody else in the country has figured out to be more efficient than Oregon universities are. And frankly, there is a point where efficiency is just a nice word for poverty, and that's where we're at. Thank you very much. I'll be very happy to answer any questions.
President Veeble, thank you very much for coming. It's good to see you again. I'm sorry we didn't leave you with more time to speak to us, but you know where my office is, and you can reach me anytime you need to. And we're working very hard to make sure that our colleges and universities will be properly funded this session. It's hard. There's never enough money to go around. And we're under a lot of pressure from others that want the money diverted someplace else. But this subcommittee understands exactly what you're saying. Madam Co-Chair?
Yes, it's President Veeble. So how's that School of Education coming along?
We're planning for it. As you know, the legislature...
Planning is not a good word.
Well, as you know, the... As you know, Madam Co-Chair, the legislature did not honor our request for funding for the School of Education in the short session last year. This year, the HEC did not prioritize it high enough to get above the line. We will be back to you in the 2017 session.
Some of us tried to make that happen.
And we know that most of the members of this committee, it's not because of lack of support on your side. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Co-Chair, yes. Some of us might just have to go up there and try to figure, you know, be creative and start, you know, remodeling ourselves, and then they have to fix it.
I mean, we might have to twist somebody's arm or beat up on somebody or...
I don't know, but education is important in this state.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Siebert, anything?
We're late.
We're adjourned.
Tomorrow, public testimony is hearing room. We're adjourned.